Daniel, Tape 8.
Chapter 7 through 12 give the answer to the question, how will God do? Now, what he'll do can be summarized in these words. Now, we took it apart in great detail and illustrated it by many principles. But the all-inclusive answer is what God will do. He will reveal his glory to the world through human instinct. That's what God will do. That's chapters 3 through 6. Now, how will God do that? That's where we are right now. For the next few weeks, as a matter of fact, for our continuation of our study of Daniel, here's the outline we'll follow. First of all, we'll give the all-inclusive answer, how will God do it? Out of chapter 7 through 12, answer the question, how will God reveal his glory to the world through his people? And then he'll just take each chapter. Chapter 7, the vision of the four beasts. Chapter 8, the vision of the ram and the he-goat. Chapter 9, the 70 years. Chapter 10 through 12, the holy war. And just illustrate, by principle, individual answers to the question, how will God make his glory known? When we're done, we ought to see what we can expect during this age of the Gentiles. Before we look at the principle suggested in chapter 7, and that's where we are this evening, let me give the all-inclusive answer. I can't prove it now, but by the time we're finished with chapter 12, I think you'll see that this is so. The all-inclusive answer, how does God reveal his glory? And the answer is, by revealing himself. He reveals his glory by revealing himself. Someone has said, history is his story. That's a pun, that's cute, but that's exactly so. History is his story. History is sacred. It's not the judgments and the decisions and the actions of men. They play it out on the human scene, on the stage. But God is the one that's in control. History is a record of the rulership of the Lord, that God is ruling. To the spiritual eye, to the spiritual man, the footprints of God are clearly seen in history. You can see it so clearly. And after all the smoke of the revolution is gone, and after everything is settled, then you can see the face of God. Because history is his story. Psalm 76:10 says, the wrath of man shall praise thee. And indeed that's so. So, how will God make his glory known? By revealing himself. Especially when we come to chapter 9. Chapter 9 of Daniel is Isaiah chapter 53. The suffering Messiah. History is nothing else but a red carpet, which is put out, rolled out for the coming of the Lord. That's all in the world it is. It all points to him. So God reveals his glory by revealing himself, by controlling governments, by dying on the cross, by battling the unseen, wicked spiritual forces of this world. Let me say, by way of application, the way God reveals his glory in history is the same way he reveals it in your life, by revealing himself. There's only one thing that God ever requires of us, and that we go forward in the revelation of himself. And as we go forward in the knowledge of the Lord and in the revelation of himself, every forward step in the knowledge of God is a forward step toward the millennium, toward the rulership of God. History is moving toward these two things: the destruction of the kingdoms of the earth and the erection of the kingdom of the Son of Man. That's true in your life. Alan Redpath said, before you can pray, thy kingdom come, you've got to be able in your heart to pray, my kingdom go. Exactly right. His kingdom will come, but my kingdom's going to go. That's history. But that's not only history, that's my life. And that's what we're going to see as we keep looking to the Lord. Man has no better occupation than to occupy himself by looking full into the face of the Lord Jesus Christ, seeing the revelation of him. That's where history leads, to a full manifestation of Jesus reigning in glory. And that's where my life should lead. To a full manifestation of Jesus reigning in glory. The rulership of the king. Okay, let's begin Daniel chapter 7. How does Daniel chapter 7 answer the question, how does God reveal his glory? There are two wonderful principles that I'd like to share with you, but it's going to take some time before I get to them. Let me take the facts of Daniel chapter 7 to illustrate the principles of God. Now, one of the dangers in studying Daniel, any chapter in Daniel, especially 7 through 12, is the danger of getting lost in a sea of facts, especially in Daniel chapter 7. Now, one practical way to get the facts before you without boring you to tears and putting you to death is by relating those facts to principles. And so that's what I'd like to do, is share some principles and illustrate them by the otherwise cold, dead, detached, impersonal facts. Now, I don't know how you feel about history. I'm not one on history. Names and places and dates and events, that can be very cold. It can be very burdensome. But I found that when facts are tied in with great principles of God, I actually enjoy the facts because it helps me remember the principles. Now, let me illustrate. The first two principles deal with this great truth. Principles of interpreting this book. When I come to understand the Bible, there are two principles, and they're illustrated in chapter 7, that are very helpful. The first is in Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. And he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. The principle is this. The Bible is written logically, not chronologically. So what are you talking about? What I'm talking about is in chapter 5, Belshazzar died. And now in chapter 7, you're only in the first year of his reign. You'd expect chapter 7 to come before chapter 5. But God doesn't write the Bible chronologically. He's written the Bible logically. In other words, God's emphasis is the message rather than the order of events. God is telling the story of redemption, the story of salvation. In Daniel, you're not moving toward Babylon or toward the Medes and the Persians or toward Greece or toward Rome. You're moving toward Bethlehem and toward Calvary and toward the millennium. That's what these things are moving toward. And so God gives it logically rather than chronologically. It's a good thing the Bible wasn't written chronologically. Or you'd get all mixed up when you read it. You'd read a few chapters in Genesis, and then you'd have to read Job. Then you'd go back to Genesis and read more of Genesis. And you'd read a little history, and you'd have to read some Psalms. And then you'd have to go back to the history, and then you'd have to read prophets intermingled in the history. Go back to the history. You'd get all mixed up. But God has written His Bible logically. The Old Testament would be like vegetable soup. They're all thrown together, and you wouldn't know what was what. Mark was written before Matthew, but the message of kingship comes before the message of service. You see, that comes first. You don't know how to serve until you know Him as King. See? 1 Thessalonians was written before Romans, but justification comes before glorification. And so God has written it logically rather than chronologically. That's the genius of the Bible, that God always emphasizes the message. And then he gradually unfolds it throughout the pages of the Bible. The second principle of interpretation illustrated by chapter 7, a passage is to be taken literally unless there's a clear reason to believe that it's figurative or symbolic. Now in chapter 7, I think you have clear reasons to believe that it's symbolic. Last time I tried to teach Daniel, I tried to draw those beasts. This time I handed out little papers, and they were already drawn. It saved me a lot of work, and it's a lot better job. I got these out of a book. These pictures describe the facts. But these facts, are they literal? Did Daniel really see a winged lion? Did Daniel really see a lopsided bear with three ribs in its mouth? Did Daniel really see a four-headed leopard with four wings? Did he really see an ugly beast with iron teeth stomping on everybody that it got in its path? Daniel 7 is clearly symbolic. Chapter 7, verse 1 says he saw dreams and visions in his mind. Verse 2, I was looking in my visions by night. He had visions from God of these four beasts. Chapter 7, verse 17, please. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who rise from the earth. So you're not left on your own to wonder what they mean. God tells you there are four kings that will rise on the earth. Look at verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth. And so it's clearly symbolic. You take a passage literally unless there's reason to believe that it's figurative. You see, in a chapter like this, you've got a lot of symbolism. You've got four winds, you've got the sea, you've got four beasts to contend with, you've got ten horns, you've got a little horn with an eye of a man and a big mouth. You've got to interpret these. These are figures of speech. So when you come to any passage of the Bible, take it literally. Now someone will say, well, what if it isn't clear? What if you're not sure if it's a figure of speech? For example, will the moon literally be turned to blood? Or is that just the figurative way of saying judgment? Will the lion really lay down with the lamb? Or is that a figurative way of saying there'll be peace on the earth? In heaven, are there really pearly gates and streets of gold? Or is that just a figurative way of describing the ineffable value of heaven? Is hellfire literal? Or is that just a figurative way of describing torment? See, fundamental evangelical Bible-believing blood-bought independent Christ-centered fundamentalists will stand up and say, it's literal! You gotta take it literally! The Red Sea turned to literal blood, and so the moon will drip with liquid blood. With red corpuscles and white corpuscles, made red by oxyhemoglobin, is that right, Don? Platelets and plasma and everything else that goes in the blood, it's literal. And the lion will literally lay down with the lamb and eat straw like an ox. And children can play with cobras because God will miraculously change the natures of those carnivorous animals. It's literal, take it literally. Of course, hellfire is literal. Even though it's accompanied with darkness, pitch darkness and blackness, it's a literal fire. You think I'm a modernist? You think I'm a liberal? Of course it's literal. Now how do you handle that? You take a passage literally unless it's clearly figuratively symbolic. But what if you're not sure? There is another principle involved. The principle can be described in these words. The reality is always greater than the picture. Reality is always greater than the picture. Jesus was pictured by animal sacrifices, and by types, and by institutions, and by clothing, and by the tabernacle. But one greater than the temple is here. He's better than all the pictures of him. But the illustration would you rather have a picture of a lifeguard or a lifeguard? Would you rather have a picture of a banquet or a banquet? Would you rather have a picture of a friend or a real friend? If you were cold, would you rather have a picture of a fire or a real fire? You see, the reality is always better than the picture. Would you rather have a picture of a diamond or a real diamond? Okay. Now what? If it's take everything literal unless it's clearly figurative. If you're not sure if it's figurative or literal, remember the principle that the reality is better than the picture, and then state it this way. If it's positive, you got positive and negative. Some things are good, some are bad. Gold in heaven, fire in hell. It's literal or better. It's literal or worse. Some people try to make hellfire figurative because they're trying to run away from the pain. They think they're toning it down. But what they don't understand is they're toning it up. If it's not real fire, it's worse. I'm not going to stand there and say it's literal. I'll say it's literal or worse. It's literal or better. I don't know for sure if there's real golden streets. It's that or better. You see what I'm saying? And so always take the Bible literally, unless there's a clear reason to believe that it's an emblem, a picture, a symbol, a figure of speech. And if you're not sure, remember, it's always literal or better. It's always literal or worse. Okay? So when you come to this chapter 7, well, you got a lot of figures of speech. And it's clearly in the figures of speech they're described for you. Let's just look at them very briefly. You can look at your little art pictures if you want to. Babylon, chapter 2, verse 4, is pictured by a winged lion. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. A winged lion. Lions, through scripture, illustrate the royal power of the king. You don't have to look this up, but in 1 Kings 10, verse 20, along with 2 Chronicles 9, 19, it describes Solomon's throne. And Solomon had 12 steps to his throne. And on each side of the step, on each step going up, 24, one on each side, he had a lion. So you can just imagine this throne with 24 lions going up to the throne. Because it illustrates royal power. And it's not surprising that Babylon was pictured by a lion. You see, a lion is the king of beasts. And evidently the eagle is the king of the birds. And in chapter 2, Babylon was described as gold, which is the king of the metals. I'm not dead sure on all the details of this. Maybe the plucking of the wings, some have suggested, refers to the insanity of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. When he was given a heart of a man, his nature was changed from that of a lion to that of a belief. The Medes and the Persians are pictured in verse 5. And another beast, the second one, resembling a bear. It was raised up on one side. I think that picture you have of the bear is not accurate. I think it's more like this. It is sort of standing on one leg. A lopsided bear. Verse 5. Resembling a bear, it was raised up on one side. 3 ribs were in its mouth, between its teeth. And thus they said, they would arise and devour much meat. Evidently, this pictures the powerful and ferocious nature, maybe the clumsy nature as well, of the Medes and the Persians. The idea of one foot, later on you're going to see the one horn rises later, but then takes ascendancy. The idea is that the Persians, even though they came up last, finally overpowered the Medes. And so it became the Persian Empire. The bear, of course, is less majestic, less swift than the lion, less glorious. 3 ribs in its mouth. I don't know what that means. Commentators, the most of them say that's Libya and Egypt and Babylon, the 3 kingdoms that the Medes and Persians took over. I don't know if that's true or not. I just take the principle. It shows the ones that were subdued. Whoever the ribs are, I'm not dead sure. And then in chapter 7, verse 6, I kept looking, behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast had 4 heads. The meaning was given to it. The four-headed, four-winged leopard. Evidently, the animals and the wings illustrate speed, velocity, quickness. Roland, who wrote an ancient history book, stated in that ancient history book, that Alexander the Great took his army in less than 8 years, 51,000 miles. Isn't that amazing thing? Swift like a leopard with wings, from Macedonia to Africa, east as far as India. Just conquered the whole land. When God wanted to show the value of gold, he talked about the gold of Ophir. When he wanted to tell you about good lumber, he talked about the cedars of Lebanon. When he wanted to talk about good beef, he talked about the cows of Bashan. And over again in the Bible, when he wants to talk about speed, the standard of comparison is the leopard. You take Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 8. He was talking about horses, and he was trying to show how fast they were. And he said they ran as fast as leopards. Leopards are pictures of speed, and evidently that's what he's showing there with the wings on the leopard. Some people try to say that the four heads of the leopard are the divisions after Alexander's death. I don't know if that's true or not. I know that within 15 years after the brilliant career of Alexander the Great, he died after a drunk or a fever. I know that his kingdom was divided among his four leading generals. And if you go through the historical background, I'll give you the names. They'll tell you that Cassander took the west, and I'll probably pronounce these wrong, Lysicinus took the north, and Ptolemy took the south, and Seleucus took the east and all. I don't know if that's true, but what I'm saying is, here's the principle. If it's clearly symbolic, then interpret the symbols, otherwise take it literally. Of course, Rome, this is the big one. This is the one, chapter 7, verse 7 and 8. After this, I kept looking in the night vision. Behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. This one scared Daniel. And it had large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. This is the one that bothered Daniel the most. He didn't even ask about the winged lion or the lopsided bear or the leopard. But look at verse 19. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. Explain that monster to me. The big iron teeth and trampling everything out. It's no secret that the next empire that took place after Greece was Rome, and most commentators believe this is a picture of Rome. Now, you're familiar that Rome had a long history, and it didn't come in like a leopard with wings either. It sort of was gradual. Yeah, let's just take this as a timeline now. We've changed pictures. It's a timeline. You know that time is divided with the birth of Christ. B.C. A.D. A.D. just means after the Lord. That's the Latin, ad dominus or whatever this means, after Christ. And this is before Christ. And history is divided that way. Well, the Roman Empire started B.C., 2 centuries before Christ. And it continued all the way through. And it went to the 1st century, the 2nd century, the 3rd century, the 4th century, 5th century, about 700 years. I've got it all here. All the battles and all that foolishness that took place. All I want you to know is that this is described, it fits at least, that he just sort of came in and taking over, and he trampled on everybody in the way, and that was the Roman Empire. And finally, it gradually built up, and it gradually declined as well, lasting for about 700 years. Let me make one point before we leave this picture of Rome. In Revelation 13, God picks up the description of this beast again, in the person John. And he describes this beast, and what he does, he shows that the beast, which would be the revived Roman Empire, absorbs the other three kingdoms. Listen at the quote, Revelation 13:2. And the beast I saw, and of course it's in inverted order, but listen. The beast I saw was like a leopard, and it had feet like a bear, and it had the mouth like the mouth of a great lion. You see, Rome had a composite character of all those other animals. In other words, when the Medes took over Babylon, they didn't just destroy and annihilate everything Chaldean. They incorporated it into their new kingdom. So that the Medes and the Persians had now some Chaldean architecture and some Chaldean art and picked up much of their language. And when Alexander the Great took over the Medes and the Persians, he took many things that were Persian. And it just became part of the kingdom. We call attention to this because when Christ comes, look at chapter 7, verse 12. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed time. That is, their life was extended in the kingdom that took over. But when Christ comes, he's not going to incorporate anything from the kingdoms of the earth. It's all over. See, he sets up a brand new kingdom, and that's illustrated here in chapter 7. I'm not going to get into the details, I'm not able to, of chapter 7. Commentaries differ as to the details of the beast. What are the 10 horns? I know they're related to the 10 toes in chapter 2, and they're related to the 10 horns in Revelation 13. I know there'll be kingdoms that say so, chapter 7, verse 10, someday. But whether or not it's the, what's that thing over in those nations, the common market or something like that, I'm not going to get into any of that. What is that horn with the eyes and a mouth? At least it fits the description of the Antichrist in the future, and we'll get into that, especially in the next chapter. But now I'm not trying to interpret those things, not in this principle. I'm trying to say, if it's literal, take everything literally, unless it's clearly symbolic, like this is clearly symbolic. If you're not sure, it's literal or better. It's literal or worse. In addition to those Bible principles, Daniel 7 also illustrates at least three principles of interpreting prophecy. Let me share those with you. Now we're going to get into the meat of the text.
Can be illustrated in the word Hebrew parallelism. Hebrew parallelism. Much of the Bible is written in Hebrew parallelism. Almost all prophecy is. Much poetry is. Parallelism simply means this. God repeats. He gives it to you line upon line. He goes over the same ground. He gives the same thing plus new information, new insights. He unfolds it gradually. That's the chart that we've been following. Chapter 2. The man had a head of silver. Or head of gold. Silver. Brass. Iron legs. Then God cut his feet off and they showed up again down here. Toes mixed with iron and clay. Babylon. The Medes and the Persians. Greece, Rome, the revived Roman Empire. Now, in chapter 6, he goes back and covers the same ground. The lion, the bear, the leopard, the monster, whatever, the beast. And he carries it into the future. The revived beast. You see? Chapter 8, he's going to come right back again and cover the same ground. He's going to talk about the ram, the he-goat. Then he's going to come right back again in chapter 9 and give you the 70 years and cover the whole period of time. That's how prophecy is. You will not understand Revelation without the principle of parallelism. If you connect all those sevens together, the seven churches followed by the seven seals, followed by the seven trumpets, followed by the seven thunders, followed by the seven personages, followed by the seven vials, you're going to miss it. Because it's the seven churches, then he comes back with the seven seals, then he comes back with the seven trumpets, then he comes back with the seven thunders, then he comes back with the seven personages, then he comes back with the seven vials, then he comes back with the seven new things. Covers the same ground. And you can't understand Revelation apart from this principle of parallelism. And so what you see in Daniel is God laying down a principle of how to interpret prophecy. And you'll see it all the way through. The same things in Ezekiel. Especially those last chapters of Ezekiel. He just goes over the same material over and over again. I'm giving you new information each time. So that's one principle. The second principle, how to interpret prophecy. Interpret prophecy in the light of its fulfillment. Now that's the easy way, but that's what the Bible teaches. Jesus laid down that principle in John 12, 16. These things his disciples did not understand at first. But when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that it was written concerning him. You understand prophecy in terms of the fulfillment. So you look back in history. It's easy for me to understand the lion with the wings now, because it's fulfilled. And it's easy if I study Alexander and I study the division of his kingdom into four divisions under the generals, and I see Antiochus Epiphanes rise up, and I see him desecrate the temple, and I see the Maccabeans come. If I look at history, it's easy to understand what was written beforehand, you see. And that's God's method of understanding prophecy. But the unfulfilled part, the 10 toes and the 10 horns and 3 horns that were plucked up and the little horn that's going to grow up, and who is it? Is the United States involved? Is it the common market? I'll tell you what it is. It's anybody's guess until it's fulfilled. I'm going to tell you all about it when I stand in my resurrection body in the millennium. Then ask me about the 10 horns and I'll tell you where they are. But right now, I believe the principle is prophecy is understood in the light of its fulfillment. And of course, I know where that principle takes you. It knocks in the head the modern idea of prophetic conferences. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't go across the street to hear a prophetic conference. I believe they're unscriptural. There shouldn't be prophetic conferences. They have no right to be giving their own opinions about the future. Instead, they should be telling men how to live in unbroken fellowship in the present with the living God. That's why God has given. He didn't write these things to show us what's going to happen in the future. He wrote these things that we might look up, not look forward, look up right now to a living God. And there's great principles involved here. Then when it all comes to pass, we'll say, oh wow, it was all written down and God fulfilled it to a T. So that's the second principle. The third principle on how to interpret prophecy, I don't have better words for it, so I'll use the words of the theologian, the law of double fulfillment. Now, I would only change the word double, and I'd put multiple. Sometimes it's more than two, that's my point. Sometimes it's triple fulfillment. Sometimes it's even quadruple fulfillment. In other words, God has many partial fulfillments before the grand fulfillment. In the future, I think all of us are familiar with the 7 years of tribulation. Jacob's going to have some trouble down the road. But Jacob's already having some trouble. Am I right? They're really going through it right now. Matthew 24, Jesus predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't believe that was fulfilled when Titus came in 70 AD and destroyed Jerusalem. But I believe the destruction in 70 AD was an earnest, a down payment, a foretaste of what's going to come in the future, you see? And sometimes it's fulfilled in more ways than one. When we talk about the little horn that rises with the eyes and a big mouth, making itself out to be God, I know that's partially fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes. I also know that it's partially fulfilled in Papal Rome. Boy, the Bible says that horn's going to wear out the saints. Over 50 million martyrs, their blood had been shed at the hand of Papal Rome, the Pope, the Catholic Church. Unbelievable. Pope Innocent III, 5 million were killed at his hand. And you just go all the way through church history, it's no secret. You read Fox's Book of Martyrs and you read famous martyrs, Wycliffe and Huss and Hooper and Tyndale and Jerome and Bradford and Cranmer and all of those, they all died at the hands of Papal Rome. And so the little horn pictures Antiochus Epiphanes, but it also pictures Papal Rome, and it also pictures Antichrist, who's going to come one day and finally fulfill that little horn. So it's multiple fulfillment, and any one prophecy might be fulfilled a number of times. But Antichrist has always been a big subject. Who's the Antichrist? And through the years, there have been many different answers. Some people thought Hitler was the Antichrist because so many Jews suffered under Hitler's hand. Or Mussolini or Khrushchev. And recently people have been thinking Kissinger was the Antichrist because he was an ambassador, so-called, of peace. You know. Someone asked a man of God one time, "Do you think Hitler is the Antichrist?" And I think he gave a very scriptural answer. He said, "He's keeping the seat warm. He's keeping the seat warm." And that's just another way to say these partial fulfillments. And then one day it'll all be fulfilled. And when it's all fulfilled, then we can understand it. But until then, I think we're called just to look to the Lord. All right, so much for the facts of Daniel chapter 7. Now, let's answer the question. How does God reveal His glory? And how's that illustrated in chapter 7? The first answer, God not only controls history, but He uses history as an object lesson. Let me see if I can drive that home. This chapter does not end with the monster at Rome. This chapter ends with the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds of glory, setting up His kingdom, and the kingdom being given over to the saints of the Most High God, and then reign on the earth. It ends in that period we call the millennium. Millennium is just a Latin word for thousand, that's all. When Jesus reigns on the earth. Now watch. God is not under the law of time. We are. We're going to live this thing out day by day. But God sees the end from the beginning. He sees the whole thing. And when I'm all done here, I've asked Bob to sing day by day. And He's going to share that with us. Because we have to live it out an hour at a time, day by day. But God sees it from the beginning. And since He's not under the law of time, it's nothing for God to say, "All right, I'm going to choose a Sabbath day, 24 hours to be a picture." What's 24 hours? He's God. And then He says, "I'm going to use a whole week called the Week Feast of Tabernacles." And for a whole week, that's just a picture. But what's 7 days? Because He's God. He's not under the law of time. If He wants to take a block of time, 7 days, to make a picture, it's all right. He said, "I'm going to take a year, a sabbatical year, take a whole year off, make it a picture." I'm not under the law of time. He can take a whole year if He wants to. And then He says, "I'm going to take 2 years. I'm going to take the sabbatical year, the 49th, and then throw in a jubilee, and it'll all be one little picture." Any Bible student will come and say, "The sojourn of Israel in Egypt was a picture. 400 years? Just to picture something? Why not? He's not under the law of time. The time in the wilderness, 40 years. Everybody says that's a picture of something. The taking of the land, the 7-year war, and the 250 some odd years that they were in there. What's 800 years to God? He can take 800 years of human history and say this is a picture." And so I suggest from Daniel chapter 7, as He gives us the panoramic view of world history, which climaxes in this. All the way through the Bible, you're going to read about the land. The whole Bible is built around the land. They're in Egypt. They get out of Egypt. They go toward the land. They take the land. They lose the land. They go back to the land. And one day they're going to come back again to the land. Everything's the land, the land, the land. Picture of milk and honey. The land. I suggest not in Joshua is Canaan a picture of Christ. If Joshua could have given them rest, he wouldn't have spoken of another day. Here's the principle. I believe with all my heart that God, who's not under the law of time, it's nothing for Him to take all human history and make it one picture. I think that's what He did. I think this is the greatest picture of Christ in the whole Bible, the millennium. It's going to finally be fulfilled. This is the land of milk and honey. This is the picture of the Christian life, not the land in Joshua's day. In the millennium, where Satan is bound, and where Christ is reigning, and where saints are living resurrection lives, literally. And where there's universal peace and universal righteousness. That's the picture of the Christian life, you see. And so He just took all of the only thing on God's heart is to show His Son. And it's nothing for Him to take all of human history and make it a picture of His Son. Let me read verses 9 through 14. "And I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. Myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat and the books were open. And I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away. But an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. That is the goal of human history. To that, everything is moving. Toward that, everything is going. And so, all human history just points to the coming of Christ. So the first way he shows his glory, he makes everything an object lesson. Even human history. The whole of human history is just one little picture of his son. See, we don't see that now. But when it's all over, we'll look back at human history and say, look at the picture he's given us of his son. The second principle may be summarized in words suggested from Genesis 3:15. I just call it the bruised heel and the crushed head principle. I figure out what the bruised heel, crushed head principle is. Look at chapter 7, verse 21. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. The horn was winning. Verse 25. And he'll speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He'll intend to make alterations in times and in law. They'll be given unto his hand for time, times, and half a time. Time is a year, times is 2 years, one and two is three, and half a time, 3.5 years. Genesis 3:15. I'll put enmity between thy seed and her seed, between the woman's seed and the seed of the serpent. Thou wilt bruise her heel, but she'll crush your head. That's the principle. There's going to be a conflict between the seed of the woman, Christ and all his followers, and the seed of the serpent, Satan and all his followers. Verse 18. But the saints of the high will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Isn't that marvelous? Look at verse 27. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be everlasting. And all his dominions will serve and obey him. We win. We win. Hallelujah, we win. I read the back of the book and we win.
Amen.
But along the way, it doesn't look like we're winning. The bruised heel. The crushed head. It's always been the endeavor of God's people to vindicate God's honor, to prevent corruption. It's always been the endeavor of Satan to sweep from the earth the people of God. That's why Matthew 16 means so much. I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You're going to get your heel bruised. That was true of the head of the body, Christ, seed of the woman. That's true of the mystical body as a whole, the church, seed of the woman. That's true of every member of the body,
you're going to get your heel bruised. That's going to finally come in the tribulation. But all along the way, you're going to get your heel bruised. But you're going to crush the head of Satan. You're going to win. It's been true of the church as a whole. When you read church history, you know, thousands are slain by the sword, and thousands are burned at the stake, and thousands are thrown into the flame and thrown to the animals. But then if you read it with any kind of an eye, thousands rise to take their place. And it's just an amazing thing to study church history. Floods of heresy and false doctrine come into the church. And then giants rise up with the truth more clearly presented than ever before. Infidelity, unbelief comes into the church. And a faithful remnant gathers. They go in the caves and they go in the hills and they go into little shanties and they bow before God. A blanket of lethargy covers God's people, and people rise up with new flame and new zeal and new enthusiasm. The church often gets sickly and weak, and it looks like it's about to die, but it's never extinguished. It's only the heel. It looks like the head, but it's only the heel. And what's true of the church is true of individuals. At every moment in your life, this is true. You're an overcomer through the overcomer. You're more than conquerors through Him that loved you. He ever leads you in His triumph. And you're soon going to crush Satan under your feet. And nothing can separate you from the love of God. But along the way, you're going to suffer, as you well know, many partial defeats. Sometimes you're going to be caught off guard. You're going to be weary in well-doing. You're going to faint. And Satan's going to harass you with temptations, but he cannot finally undo the radical work that was done in your heart when you trusted Jesus Christ as your Savior. He can diminish your efforts. He can impede your growth. He can inject doubts and suspicions in your heart. He can put you in all kinds of bondage so that you become an ascetic or some kind of a legalism or live a life of license. He can put you on tangents, and he can spoil you through the philosophy of vain deceit. One day he's going to think he really has the victory, because that old heart of yours is going to stop, and that hunk of clay is going to fall down to the earth, and Satan's going to think, I've infused into that man a poison which will make him return to the dust. Even though God has made him so marvelously and intertwined him with veins and blood vessels, with muscles and sinews, and given him the breath of life, Satan says, finally, I'll take that framework down joint by joint and particle by particle and rafter by rafter, and he'll return unto the dust and be resolved back into the original elements. But he can't annihilate one particle. And there'll be a day when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that live shall hear. And we're going to yet sing, Death, where is your victory? And grave, where is your sting? You see, Satan, it's true that during my life, he can batter me along the way, and he can discourage me, and he can mar me by successful temptations, and he can detain my body for a little while in the grave. But in my flesh, I see God. He's only got my heel. He can't touch my head. And boy, I wouldn't trade anything for that first promise in the Bible. I know that sometime, and I say this with a pain in my heart, sometime it looks like Satan has reached ahead of many of God's children. I've seen some men that I've greatly respected, giants in the faith. I've seen them come down. Come down in immorality. Come down in heresy. Come down in drunkenness. But when the war is over, when the dead in Christ shall rise and the Spirit soars away to be with the Lord, when they stand there robed in white with palms in their hands in their resurrection bodies, then we're going to understand, as we can't understand down here, that Satan can only reach the heel. No matter what it looks like, he can't touch your head. And in Daniel chapter 7, that's what you see. Finally,
the saints are being worn out. And Antichrist, the horn, is just destroying them and overpowering them.
But then, Christ comes and the head is crushed. And we finally have the victory. Satan will feel his defeat. And he'll be conscious when he sees us in our new bodies that he has lost the battle. And we'll all crush him under our feet.
How will God show his glory? He makes everything a picture of Christ. All of human history is a picture of Christ. And through the principle of the bruised heel and the crushed head.
Now, so that you don't go away from this chapter remembering a winged lion and a lopsided bear with ribs in his mouth and leopard and an ugly looking beast, let me just state it. I won't develop it. I'll just state it. Four ways God's presented in this chapter. The first way, very obviously, Isaiah 46:10. The one who declares the end from the beginning. He's, and what's true of history is true of your life. The second way, verses 9 and 10. The Holy Judge. What a scene of blazing glory. Innumerable saints and angels all around. The judgment is set. The books are open. He's the Ancient of Days. And then verses 13 and 14. The royal Son of Man. The one who's coming in the clouds of glory to set up his kingdom on the earth. And I think most beautifully of all in this chapter. Verses 14, 18, 21, 22, and 27. Notice what it says. Verse 14. That they might serve him. Verse 18. The saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom. You'd expect it to say the highest one will receive the kingdom. But it doesn't say the highest one. It says the saints of the highest one. Verse 21. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Verse 27. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. Union with the king. What a picture of God. The one who sees the end from the beginning, the Ancient of Days, the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, and the one who's united with his bride and shares his kingdom. Well, God sees it all at once. That's all human history. But we go through it a tick at a time. Step by step. Day by day. It's going to happen. We're going to win it. We're already on the winning side. But we have to go through day by day. I've asked Bob to sing that song, Day by Day. And let's just trust the Lord to use it in our hearts.